Hey everybody, it's me, Patricia Corey, and you've tuned in to Beyond the Matrix, the radio show that you know by now dares you to think outside the box of convention. And that is a funny intro considering all my life my guest today has been giving me challenge to try to get back in a little bit. We've had a wonderful balance growing up. My guest today is my brother Bob, my older brother, who's going to be talking of, well, we're going to just explore the financial debacle that's happening and get some insights from both sides on what really is going down. But before he comes on, many of you have been writing and just the most beautiful messages about me leaving the show. I want to thank you from the heart for that, and I want you to know that I'm not going. I'm just taking a quick hiatus. I'm sure Dawn will find a spot for me when it's time for me to come back because, God, I've got a new book that needs to be started from the council. I've got journeys. I've got so many things going on, and I just can't really manage it all at this moment. So don't think I'm going away. I'm just taking a break from the radio because as long as I have a breath to breathe, I am going to speak my truth, and I know you want to hear it, which I'm greatly honored about, and I promise you I will not leave. So this is the second to the last show for now, but just put it in your calendar to check back a few months down the road, and I will hopefully be back on BBS with the same title, the same bat station, and the same intention to bring light into the darkness of ignorance. And my other message is, you know, my trips are really filling up now. People are asking me a lot of questions about Egypt because I proposed two different trips to Egypt this year. Because last year I had 75 people on one trip, and I'll never do that again. It was too many people, and although we had an amazing time, I got worn out. So I've got my first trip February 7th to the 20th. I need you to, if you're really contemplating that, to start thinking about signing up. And that one is going to be very special because we're going to visit the land of Pharaoh Akhenaten, Tel Amarna. And because it's going to be one of my smaller trips ever, I don't anticipate having more than 20 people on that program. So it's an occasion for me to get very close and really be able to spend personal time with each and every person who comes. So please give that some serious thought. You can find the information on my website, SyrianRevelations.net, as you well know. And for all the questions about the other journey in November, I haven't got that finished yet, so keep your eye on the website for updates. And because of what we're talking about today, the finances of planet Earth, I wholeheartedly recommend, whether it's with me or another teacher or whether you plan to do it on your own, get to the sacred sites of planet Earth. Enjoy your life. Don't get crazy. Don't overextend yourself. But make every minute count. Remember, you came onto this planet on a spirit quest. And what better way to do that than to explore the beauty that still remains and the power spots of Earth and the magic and the history of spirit beings like you have left their marks in Egypt, in Peru, in England. It's all there. Breathe it in. Celebrate what has come before you, just as much as you contemplate what is coming. Okay, that's my spiel, and I'm proud of it. I'm going to introduce him now, my brother Bob. By the way, I never bring family into my public persona because it's very private to me, but Bob has been an influence. I'd say he's been a grounding influence for me. He's a very wise man, a good, good man, and he knows a lot about what's going down. He helps, like I said, he helps me keep it in balance so that I'm not always going, he has been an individual investment counselor. He has been a VP for many years with a major telecommunications company. And here he is. Hi, Bob.
How are you, Pat?
I'm great. Thanks for coming on. This is Jeff. Finally, you're on the show. And I'm really excited about what we're going to do today. So I'm going to ask you to remember that my audience is not interested in probably not interested in knowing about personal portfolios and all that. What we want to do is be edgy and talk about just as much as you possibly can give us insight. What in the world is coming down? Now, I would like to say that the points of interest for me are, you know, many people don't even understand who Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and what that was about. What is subprime and why that all went wrong? And then from there, oh, God, I think in an hour we'll probably be able to touch a tenth of what I'd like to talk about. But if you could start by just giving us an over, very simple terms, because you know me, I don't like the highfalutin brain drain information on finances. What started this Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae mortgage disaster?
Well, that's a great place to start. Fannie Mae, which stands for the Federal Home Mortgage, Federal National Mortgage Association, that was put into place by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1938. The purpose of Fannie Mae was to prop up the housing market, which had collapsed. And since it was a goal of the government to help people enjoy the American dream, which involves home ownership, and since bankers, the banking system had collapsed, Fannie Mae was to put in place to help provide liquidity, to help provide stable interest rates to banks so that lending could be increased, so people could buy houses. That's, that was its charter, to promote affordable housing for the American people. That's the charter of Fannie Mae in 1938. And it was a government regulatory government agency, if you will. Fast forward to 1968, and for those that might be old enough to remember the Vietnam War era and Lyndon Johnson, and the fact that we had growth of social programs and very heavy military expenditures, Lyndon Johnson privatized Fannie Mae, made it into a private company with government backing so that it wouldn't, its budget would not appear on the government's balance sheets, if you will. So in other words, in order to make the deficit look smaller, we spun off Fannie Mae and made it into a private company.
Okay. So when did it start to go extremely sour with these subprime mortgages?
Well, it went sour. What's happening is as banks make loans, Fannie Mae does not make home loans direct to consumers. Nobody's ever had a Fannie Mae loan. So what happens is the bank goes and lends 100 mortgages. There's 100 mortgages out there, let's say. And so Fannie Mae will bundle these, and that's what is called a mortgage-backed security. If you've heard about that in the newspaper and the whole subprime thing, which I'll get to in a little more detail. So just imagine you've got 100 friends, they all have a mortgage, and Fannie Mae has bundled these into a security and sold it to Wall Street as an investment vehicle, because houses are going up in value, the interest rates that people are paying for mortgages are a form of a return on investment. So that's what Fannie Mae is doing. And by the way, Freddie Mac, just to, so that, that if somebody's wondering what's the difference between the two, it was a duplicate agency that was put in place I think a couple of years, 1970 maybe, after the 68 privatization. And it was done simply so that Fannie Mae wouldn't be a monopoly. Since these were now private companies, not government agencies, the government thought it would be a great idea. Let's have two of these guys so that they can be competitive and it won't appear that there's a monopoly.
Okay.
So things, where do things start to go wrong? Since Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are basically guaranteeing low interest rates, and they are picking up these mortgages and selling them to the as securities. Well, when we got into this mess of housing got so expensive, and we had this creative financing, things like the subprime simply means that banks were lending money at rates cheaper than what the largest corporations could do. They were creating such incentives to buy houses that people started to buy houses that they couldn't really afford. So in the old days, a good rule of thumb was if you had 20% down and if your payment left over was going to be something that looked like a third of your household income, then you met the affordability test, and that was a good idea for you to buy a house. Well, when we got into this crazy spiraling real estate bubble, which started in about 2001 and went for a good 6-7 years before things collapsed, that got thrown out the window. The federal government was making was printing so much money and making easy money so plentiful that the banks had to loan them. And there weren't as many people that could afford the 20% down and the 80% remaining payment with a third of their income. So that kind of went out the window. So they went with low interest loans, no interest loans, negative amortization loans, if you can imagine that, which means basically we won't worry about getting the payment we need now, Mr. Customer. We'll take it as the house increases in value. So you build this house of cards because you've got everybody buying property that they can't afford, and then everything collapsed. And because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-supported, even though they're private enterprises, the taxpayer is on the hook for a lot of those mortgages.
Okay. So now I hear that there are neighborhoods in the States, because I've been out of the States now for 26 years, and I'm seeing that there are neighborhoods in the States that, like, one out of every four houses on a street is in foreclosure. Is that a clear picture of the situation?
It's more like it's the risk that one out of four. And the reason that that many foreclosures is not coming onto the market is because it will really collapse prices. So what the government and what the banks are doing, which is the whole idea of the financial bailout, was to prop them up to the extent that they would have cash that they could in turn lend, which of course they have not done. So they're trying to hold these. If you try to buy a foreclosed property, it's very hard. The banks are very slow because they're hoping that this market will turn around. And if it turns around, then their assets that they're holding, which they consider, which you've heard this toxic asset expression. Toxic asset simply means they own a home that the borrower owes $250,000, but if they sell it in the marketplace, it's only worth $175,000. Well, the banking rules say that you don't have to declare that as a loss until you actually sell it. So they are holding on to this vast quantities of real estate from people who can't afford to make the payments, hoping that things will turn around a little bit. So these foreclosures that come onto the market get, I won't say trickled in, but they are not just flooding the market at all one time.
So what is this recent information that's come out that now they've discovered that it's been a whole foreclosure fraud, and that many of the foreclosures that were done weren't legal and weren't done with the proper grounds, et cetera? Where does this all stand? What's happening to America?
Well, the skeptics will say that this is a huge land grab, that if you've got the government backing the mortgage industry and you've got massive amounts of foreclosure, then the banks are going to end up with all these properties.
And what are they going to do, sell them to the Chinese?
Well, that's possible.
The rapidly changing face of planet Earth, eh?
Yeah,
it's an intense situation in that regard, and
what's very interesting is that while the housing prices are dropping, which would appear to be, may I use the word deflationary?
Yeah, we need to talk about deflation and inflation.
But if at the same time, if you go down to the lumber yard to buy a stick of lumber or to buy a piece of copper, the prices are off the charts. So what we have is ultra inflation and high prices. I mean, simply put, you can't begin to build a house for what you can buy a foreclosed property. So that would suggest that the intrinsic value of a lot of this real estate is worth more than
well, so what
they're able
to get.
So
you've got neighborhoods of foreclosed properties. You then have the potential for vandalism, violence, and I mean, doesn't it? Don't you seem like it's just a slippery slope? I personally, if I had a house that I was still managing to pay for and eight houses around me that were in foreclosure, I'd be a little uncomfortable in my neighborhood.
Very definitely.
Wow. Pardon me. What do you recommend? I mean, I know that you can't give financial advice, but how do you see this as an individual who is contemplating home ownership now? Do you think it's a good idea to be investing in a home? Ha ha, the tricky question.
I say yes with these provisos. I didn't want to start with it depends. I like yes or no and then the expansion. So I say yes. And there are parts of the country where the housing collapse has been far more serious because the speculation has been far greater. So if you take markets like Las Vegas, Phoenix, Arizona, people were buying everything as fast as they could nail it up. And so, though, as a result of that skyrocketing increase, the collapse has been correspondingly greater. If you go to some very nice places in the country, you know, the middle America, Omaha, Nebraska, Kansas City, Kansas, Minneapolis, you go to a lot of cities that have not had this boom-bust cycle. Inflation is, unemployment is very low there. The economies are stable. The schools are good, and their prices are off. Maybe let's say they're 10 to 20% lower compared with 50 or 60% lower in places like Las Vegas and Phoenix. So there are many more stable areas, and for someone that has got the down payment and reasonably stable job and wants to buy a home, then I think that's great. I think that interest rates right now are very low. So wow. It's always been true that the total cost of what you pay for a house, when you take into account the interest, makes the interest rate of more importance than the actual price of the house. So if you
interrupt you and ask you what you define as a reasonably stable job.
Well, if you work for the government or if you work for a utility company, if you work for some industries, I guess, are more stable than others. But let's be real. We know that the job picture in the U.S. is horrible.
Well, bear in mind that we're not only speaking to people in the U.S., we're speaking to people all around the world. So I'd like to innovate a minute and talk about, I personally, as you know, I'm not employed, I'm self-employed, let's say, and I think it's so important for people not to wait for an eventual letter from an employer, but to take the time now to investigate things that they can create for themselves while they're still employed, that could be potential businesses that create a revenue, that are a service, some special service or art or something that they personally create and manage, and I'd like to know what your opinion is of that.
I think that's a terrific suggestion. It's interesting that on the investment side, people will always talk wisely about the need to diversify. But on the income-generating side, the more that you have the eggs in one basket, you have one breadwinner, you have a job that is salary-oriented, jobs go away and you're suddenly stuck. So if you have low savings, you only have one household earner, I'm kind of using the extremes, people who are out of work sometimes are the great innovators. They're doing part-time work plus they're creating something on the side. I think that's very positive.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a time to become more energized. I mean, a lot of people say, you must be kidding, I work a 9-to-5 job and when I get home I'm exhausted. But I definitely, being a person that works about 12 hours a day and loves it, I definitely think there's room for people to get the energy, which is the excitement, to be able to create, to really investigate what it is that is their passion and see how they can then transform that into a service or a product that they can, they certainly have the means to promote with all of the distribution networks we have now through the net.
Yes.
Well, you hit a word that I love, which is I probably never, ever will have, which is savings. And we know now there's a lot of talk in all the gloom and doom overview of what's coming down on this planet that the money's going to be devalued. I think it was I just heard yesterday somewhere that because of the 600 million, I can't even keep a track of these numbers, 600 billion new dollars being printed, even though there is no money behind them, that this is going to drag down the money that you do have by 10 to 20%, the dollars that you are sitting on. Do you have anything that you can talk to us about that? I mean, we're hearing already that the groceries are just going berserk, double-digit inflation, and I don't know how much of this is true. What's happening?
Well, if we want to step back, are you interested in stepping back a little bit and quickly running through how we got to fiat currency from gold standard? Or the whole idea of gold?
If you can keep it simple, because not all of us have the financial lingo.
I'll keep it simple. In the old days, and the old days are defined prior to 1970. The world all agreed that their money, their currency should be pegged to gold. That's what we agreed to. All the countries agreed in 1944, right towards the tail end of World War II. And in order to have a stable monetary system, remember we had had the Great Depression, there was the agreement that we should all adhere to printing no more money than we had gold to back it. That's where the expression, it's as good as gold, comes from. Because a dollar could be, used to actually say gold certificate, and it was payable to the bearer on demand a dollar's worth of gold. And the idea was
wasn't the dollar saying silver certificate?
Those came later. And now they say Federal Reserve note in God we trust. So simply put, because the U.S. had 80%, we had all the gold, and nobody wanted to ship gold back and forth, which is kind of clumsy, that while it was agreed that gold would be the international standard, the result was the dollar became the standard. So we are the world's reserve currency. So as much trouble as we're having America's having with its currency, if we no longer become the world's currency, we will see it collapse even more.
Well, that's what everybody's talking about, letting go of the dollar as the world currency.
What we have to remember is that other countries, since there is no more gold standard, that got thrown out in the 70s. Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard, and all the other countries followed suit. That includes the Swiss, too, by the way, that there's no currency out there that's backed completely by gold. And there's an argument that says it wasn't a good idea in the first place. It's a little too rigid. You can't, as economies expand, you should be able to print money equal to the growth of your economy. And what's happened is this has all worked very well, except now countries have run away with it. We had the problem with Argentina, the South American countries. You're hearing about Greece. You're hearing about Spain. But America is the 800-pound gorilla because we are the largest economy, and we've got trillions of these paper dollars all over the world.
So why are we printing another 600 billion trillion? Now they're saying it's a trillion.
We're printing 600 billion more. And by the way, a lot of people don't know that it's no longer a requirement for the government to report on the money supply. You used to be able to read that in the paper. And now that's gone away. So we don't really know how many dollars there are.
Does that sound like runaway government to you?
Well, it's runaway. If you remember Howard Ruff, who was the gold bug of the 70s, he made a very clear statement that when governments have huge deficits, there's only so many things they can do. One of them is to pay the money back One is to go bankrupt and to default, and the other is to inflate it away. Print so much money that you're going to pay the debts back, but you're going to pay it with dollars that aren't worth anything. So what
right.
you're
there's,
listening
to... There's another possibility, and that is to sell off all the land to foreign interests that they owe money to.
Yes, he left that out, and he left out the option that the economy could grow enough that you could soak up this debt. And in fact, that's what happened when Reagan first undertook policies, lower taxes that created deficits. We soaked those up because we went through a major economic expansion phase. I bet most of your listeners would agree that the likelihood for America to have this major economic expansion against global competitiveness is probably nowhere near as likely as it was in 1980.
Well, yeah, and you look at the fact that manufacturing is on a sharp decline in the States, and, of course, the unemployment is increasing, and you ask the simple question, this is not me being a genius, how in the world will the United States ever pull this out? Out of those options that you listed, I don't see the economy kick-starting a vast new supply of manufacturing. I mean, it's all gone.
Well, this is what Obama was hoping for when he talked about a new wave of clean energy, that we need to be the solar, the compressed natural gas. We need to be promoting the things that we have.
Right, but the problem is that every time they try to do anything about clean energy, the big oil kahunas stop it.
Yes.
So that's kind of spitting in the wind, isn't it?
That's right. I agree with your point that is that likely that we're going to see this major expansion? I don't see it.
What do you see? I mean, I'm asking you just as a person and not as a financial expert.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see? I mean, down the road here, which we hear words, very frightening words. People are getting very uncomfortable with the second depression. Obama announced the other day about avoiding a second depression. We hear that we're out of the recession. We hear that it's a double dip recession. What is your take on where we stand right now?
Well, we are. It's very precarious, to say the least. And yeah, the stock market is up, and now these terms that the government uses, like quantitative easing, which is basically we're printing more money, guys. But they use words like quantitative easing because I believe that goes over the head of most people.
Yes.
Like, okay, the government, they're doing something. So we are doing what we have told other countries who got in trouble that they cannot do. We are trying to spend our way out of trouble and promote and invest and to rev up the engines and get the economy moving again so tax rates will increase and so forth. The United States have overseen other countries' problems like Argentina, we always say to them, you have to cut back, you have to tighten your belt, you have to go on an austerity program, get your inflation under control, and so forth. We tell them you have to endure some pain to get through this. Our government is not willing to do that.
We could start with Obama's, I hate to be sarcastic, but his $200 million a day trip that he's on, which Pentagon said it's not that much. So let's say $150 million to be kind.
Yes.
You've got this ridiculous, you know, spending like they want to change all of the street signs in Manhattan from capital letters to lowercase letters because it's safer, to the tune of $65 million. And yet the people are being asked to tighten their belts and be in obedience and pay their taxes and suck it up in a sense. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, how do they get away with this? Well, the answer is they're not getting away with it, I guess. I mean, you know, obviously the so-called elections showed a public that was more aware than before.
Yes.
But not aware enough to you know, okay, great, so now you've got all this energy shifted to the Republicans. And it really is time for people to understand that it isn't about parties. How do you feel about that?
Oh, absolutely. It's no matter who you, the illusion of choice, as I like to refer to it.
Yeah.
And there is choice, but I made a comment once to someone that one man's social program is another man's aircraft carrier. And that if for all of your listeners and for you and I, we know that we should enjoy life. We should buy things that are within our means. And the government does not do that because it has this ability to print money, without consequence, because it's the good faith and credit of the United States of America, and somehow future generations will pay or we'll grow out of our way out of the problem, that they're okay with spending $1.30, $1.40 for every dollar they take in. So they want low taxes because the wealthy constituency likes that. They want social programs because that liberal democratic constituency wants that. And the net result is, regardless of arguing which of these programs are good, we can't afford them. We had a revolution in 1776 based on taxation without representation. Who's representing the generations in the future that have to pay all this debt back?
Well, who's representing these generations that are still here trying to make sense of it?
Yes, that's correct.
So, what's coming now? You and I have had personal conversations where you've talked about a deflationary recession. Again, keep it simple. And versus an inflationary recession. And it all boggles my mind because I must have flunked financial or economics 101 somewhere along the road. But what is the difference? What does it mean to us? Because we're hearing that we're moving in, we are now going to be facing high inflation because of these, particularly because of this new, they've upped it to $1 trillion printout from the Federal Reserve, which we need to get to. And that this is going to cause inflation. What are your feelings about that, and what is the difference between inflation and deflation?
Deflation is, let's start with a very simple. Deflation is when the cost of goods and services is going down and nobody has any money. So you have too few dollars chasing too many goods. And inflation is too many dollars chasing too few goods, so the price is going up. So a cup of coffee is, in an inflationary environment, the window sign, it says 75 cents today, tomorrow is 95. So in a hyperinflationary mode, people are buying things they don't even need just because they're worried about it'll be more tomorrow. And deflationary environment, cash is king. In the Great Depression in America, cash was king. They weren't printing money willy-nilly. The banks, whatever they had, weren't lending. It was backed by gold. And if you had cash, you were king. So where we are headed now, in order for us to have a deflationary collapse, it would appear that the government would have to do the opposite of what it's doing. It would have to stop printing and say, we're going to have to soak up this, we're going to have to tighten our belts, et cetera, et cetera. So the more that they are printing, it's leading us to a more severe weakening of the dollar. And what does that mean? It means that you can buy fewer things with your dollars. It takes more dollars to buy what you're trying to buy. What's been a little strange is with all this government printing of money, you still hear everywhere that people don't have a lot of money. It's not like the masses are flush with cash, and that's part of this. I was listening to an economist from Columbia University talking about the artery clogging of the monetary system, that the banks their balance sheets have been pumped up by the federal government, meaning they've given them more money with the idea that you need to loan it, but they're not loaning it. So the banks are flush with cash. Corporations are doing pretty well with cash, but they're not hiring yet because everybody wants to wait and see what's happening. So there's this constriction mode even though the government is trying to pump, and print more and more dollars. If you want me to, now, so let's go back with what do I personally think will happen. The government is facing these massive deficits that it can only try to pay for with weakened dollars. I believe that they will keep printing, and we're going to still see this quantitative easing. And one of the ways to improve our competitive position in the world, by the way, is with a weaker dollar. So for your listeners, I think we understand that if you are a European and the euro is strong against the dollar because the dollar is dropping in value, it means that when you go to the automobile showroom, you are more likely to buy a Ford than you are a Peugeot, because the foreign exchange rate makes the American goods very competitive. So a strong dollar would hurt us, would hurt America very much. So it would make their exports less competitive. And so since our exports against imports are so poor as it is, I believe the government actually likes a weak dollar for a couple of reasons. That being one of them, multi-corporations like the idea that we can help our exports. And two, they can fund all these Social Security and Medicare and so forth with dollars that are less and less valuable.
Okay, Bob, the line dropped for a minute, so I didn't hear what you just said. Did you describe deflation and inflation?
Yes, I don't know how far back did I lose you.
That's okay. As long as you were fine and my audience heard you, I can pick it up from here. Sometimes we have these little perturbations on the line.
That's okay. I just didn't want to repeat myself. If your listeners got the deflation versus inflation.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of listeners writing in saying this is very dynamic information. We're very excited, and a few of them want to ask you some questions. So I'm going to put the line out there.
Okay.
A reminder to people that if they want to call in and ask you questions, we've got another 20 minutes, and the number, of course, is 888-815-9756. Let me give it to you again. It's toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-815-9756. So just refresh me, Bob. Did you say we were going into inflation or deflation?
Inflation.
Okay, GAC. So what does that mean to people that are, is it really going to be like 10? I heard on the on my sources that we could rapidly see a 5 to 8% inflation within weeks. Yeah. What do you think about that? Is that exaggerated?
I don't recall historically. I don't know that it's more likely to. Well, it's possible. I don't want to say. The forces at work, you would think that inflation would tend to roll on and start to get worse, but I don't know that it's instantly going to flip on like a light switch.
Well, a few weeks ago I had a guy on whose name is Paul Brockton, who is a big advocate of gold and silver. And I have to laugh because many of us don't have the money to invest in a stock of gold or silver, and a lot of people are just making ends meet. But
I lost you again, Pat. Pat was about to ask, I think, about gold and silver, and while she's coming back on,
the person whom you're trying to.
That's all right. The question is gold and silver. And most people have seen that gold and silver have been rising. And that's because they are considered historically to be a store of value. You know, historically, for example, an ounce of gold, it's been said, will buy a suit of clothes. In the 1930s, you could buy a men's suit of clothes for $35 to $40, and lo and behold, an ounce of gold was worth $35. Today, gold is up to $1,360, and an expensive man's suit might be $800 or $900. So gold.
I'm back.
You're back. You were just talking, Pat, about gold and silver, and I, in an effort to keep talking a little bit with your listeners, just started talking a little bit about the background of gold and silver.
Okay, great. Keep telling us.
So reminding
people that during the war, they had to give up their own personal gold, their wedding rings, gold in their teeth. I mean, you know, it's pretty outrageous that the government can command that you give them your gold. All right, Bob, I'm going to interrupt because we've got Jim from Ohio with a call-in question. Hiya, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Hello, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
What's your question?
Hey, I was wondering what you would recommend for somebody that's just scraping by, you know, doesn't have a lot in savings and, you know, just watching every penny they're spending, and what would you recommend?
Is that for Bob or for me? Jim?
Well, for your expert, you know, what he thinks he should do.
And Jim, when you say do about what, do you mean do about investing or do about your spending, or what do you mean by do?
Well, I mean, it could be either one, but I don't have much to invest or much to spend. I mean, you know, I'm just taking care of basics, you know? That's what I'm wondering.
Right.
What, you know, in the next year or two, what would you suggest? Any extra money that I have to invest or do, what would you recommend that I do?
I need to say that I am not currently an investment counselor, so I can't give you individual personal advice. But in the context of this discussion we've been having about where things are going, I would certainly not have any credit card debt, for example. I would be trying to get rid of any kind of variable debt. If I had a variable mortgage, if I own a home and I had a variable mortgage, I would be doing everything I could to lock in these low rates and have a fixed mortgage. Because if inflation comes, does that help to answer your
question? Well, I mean, I don't have a home. I'm in an apartment. But if can't they, even though you have a fixed, if it went way up, couldn't they still change it, the interest rate?
No. At least that's not happening.
No matter how bad the conditions are, they could not raise it. If somebody got it at 5 or 6%, they can't raise it, huh?
That's never happened before.
Yeah, well, I think we're in new times, though. That anything could happen. That's
well, you have a contract with the bank. I mean, I like to think that there are enough bad things that could happen that are more likely than that. So it's more likely that if you have one of these low interest variable loans or a teaser rate on a credit card so that you think that you're okay with your ability to buy things and make the payments, but then if inflation comes and the interest rates spike upwards, you want to have the kind of debt that doesn't go up. And I think the banks will have so many people whose loans they can raise legally because they're adjustable, that they won't have to try to do something illegal like increase a fixed rate loan. At least that's what your point's well taken, that is it possible they could do anything, but I would like to deal with the things that are more likely before we deal with the historically has never happened but is still possible.
So the first thing is any extra money, pay off the credit cards. Get the balance to zero.
Yes. Because the interest, if you pay 10% interest on a credit card, and some of the interest rates are 20%, and you pay that off, then you just made a 10% return on your money. Do you see that?
Right.
So an expense elimination is equal to a return on your investment. So if I had $10 and I could pay off $10 worth of debt, that they were charging me a 10% interest rate, or put it in the bank and earn half a percent, or now they're paying hardly anything, which is part of this low-interest effort to get the economy pumping is killing people who are trying to save because they can't get any yield or income out of their savings. So, yes, that's the first thing I would do.
And as far as investing, what do you think about the stock market?
The rule of thumb for investing in the stock market is that over long periods of time, the market has gone up. In inflationary times, stocks generally have historically gone up. Now, we're facing some rough times, so there are some rules of thumb that say, for example, if you need the money within 5 years, you should not be in stocks. So money that can be 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, long-term growth, then keep putting dollars in on a systematic basis. The market will go down. You'll get more shares with the dollars that you're investing. Let's say you put $100 into the stock market, half internationally and half in the U.S., and you did that $100 a month for the next 20 years. Well, the markets would drop, so your $100 would buy more shares when it's low. When the market goes up, you buy fewer shares, but you're averaging. It's called dollar cost averaging. And over the long haul, historically, over the last 100 years or more, stocks have risen. Will they do it again? Yeah. I don't know. Most people don't know that we had a major stock crash in 1900. Everybody talks about 1929. There have been these 30-year waves where the market crashes, then it gets stable, it goes up, and we did very well up until the big bubble of 2000, and then it crashed, and then we came back, and we've had a very jagged sawtooth ride from 2000 to where we are now. So if you go talk to an investment advisor, I'm sure that, and you ask them about stocks, they would say to you, how long is this money? When is this money going to be needed that you're putting away? If you think you need it for college or you need it for living within 5 years, you should not touch the stock market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And from 2000 to 2010, if I had, say, $100 a week I could put into, the stock market or, say, a 4% CD, what would have performed better by 2010?
We're in 2010. Do you mean by 2020?
Well, I'm going to say 2010 because, you got past data that you know what happened with a stock market or with, just a CD at a bank.
Right. 4%. The reason I asked that, today you cannot find a 4% CD.
I'm just saying when you say you could find one back in 2000, whatever, 3%, 4%, whatever, what would you have done looking back now with the past data? Would you put that money into a CD or the stock market?
The CD is more for shorter-term money. So I would have divided things up, assuming I might need some of that money, and I would have gone after some of the CD, and I'd have put my long-term growth money into the market, both internationally and domestically. The answer is I would have done both.
Okay. So it's not like the CD overall, even though it's slow, did better than the stock market.
No, I didn't say that. It is more stable. And if you have, if inflation should really rise, I think Pat might know that my first home I bought, which was in 1976, the interest rate on that fixed mortgage was 9.75%. But the house price was low enough and my income was high enough that I said, well, that's the interest rate. It must be what it is. And you remember a few years later, we heard about interest rates went to 12, they went to 14, and the inflation rate was 18. And then things kind of settle down a little bit. So the answer is if you, for the safety of a CD at 4%, if you have 6-8% inflation rate, you are getting killed. You're losing money on your CD.
Right.
The answer would be you do both. An advisor would tell you, Where's your short-term money? There are all kinds of things, Jim, like what is your risk tolerance? What is your spouse's risk tolerance if you have a spouse? So that you are time horizon, how long do you need the money? How comfortable do you sleep at night with the idea that the market drops 10 to 20%? Do you have a heart attack over that? I mean, Pat is always talking about we need to live our life and enjoy the beauty of the world. You can't enjoy that very much if you're fretting over your portfolio. So the answer is you would want an advisor to help identify your risk tolerance, your time horizon for when you need the money, your capacity to be adding to your investments every month. There's a big difference in strategy whether you're going to do $100 a month for 10 years or you're going to take $50,000 and push the chips across the table and try to bet on which area. But an advisor would tell you to diversify into everything, and maybe precious metals might even have a place.
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, Bob, I have been cut off yet again, and now we are just at the end of the show, so I'm going to have to interrupt your conversation with Jim. I think you're still on with Jim.
I am. I think
yeah.
I've...
Well, thank you very much for all your information. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Take care. Have a good day.
And whatever Bob was telling you, I'd like to add to this. Explore some ways to create new revenue for yourself. There are so many things that you can invent. I have a friend who just opened a dog walking business. And she goes out at night walking dogs, which she adores. And she's got like 10 clients now, and she makes somewhere between $200 and $300 a week walking the dogs. So get creative and see what you can invent so that you can stash some money.
Great advice.
This is a time of opportunity. There are people that are creative and are saying, okay, I don't want to be in the fear zone, and I don't want to be stuck. So what can I create? Like dog babysitting, dog walking. It's amazing how many people are willingly pay for someone to take care of that for them and how many other things that we take for granted that can be done. So put on your thinking cap and get into abundance mode and trust that you are protected. And we're going to have to close on that positive thought. And, Bob, I really thank you. I'm sorry I got cut off so many times, but I know that you – shined your brilliance through to the audience, and I thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, Pat. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot. And, folks, that was my big brother, and I'm proud. And next week is my last week for a while, so please tell your friends to tune in. I'm sure I'm going to have a surprise for you. I don't know what it is yet, but it's going to be a bang. So thanks for tuning in to Beyond the Matrix, the radio show that dares you. And, man, I'm telling you, get out of the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. And if you remember my spiel last week, just get mad as hell and not take it anymore. Aho! And with that, I'm signing out. Loving you all. Thank you so much for your support and for all the good things you're doing to make our world a better place.